You are listening to Aloud, a program of the Library Foundation of Los Angeles. Visit us at lfla.org.
Hello and good evening and welcome to a new season of Aloud. I'm Jessica Strand, the Director of Public Programming at the Library Foundation of Los Angeles. This season will focus on resilience, something we are all very aware of at this moment. And I can't think of someone who represents this more personally to me than the poet activist Ian Manuel. We were lucky enough to have him on May 5th with the great social justice activist and lawyer Brian Stevenson to discuss his compelling memoir, My Time Will Come, a memoir of crime, punishment, hope, and redemption. The conversation was so interesting that we decided we'd ask Ian back to talk more about his work and the power poetry had in his life. I want to talk briefly about the Library Foundation and its role. The Library Foundation of Los Angeles is instrumentally involved in supporting many programs of the Los Angeles Public Library. But tonight, I want to talk about a particular program, Teens Leading Change, TLC, which provides teens an avenue to make a difference in their communities. One of these programs touched on the criminal justice system in a smart and proactive way. One of the groups explored the school's use of discipline and how it can contribute to the school to prison pipeline. Teens in this program reach out to activists, arts educators, civil rights lawyers, and arts and school administrators to learn more. With the information they gathered, they conducted interviews with their teachers and used what they learned to reflect on educational alternatives. This is where change begins. The next round of the TLC Civic Action Projects takes place on October 2021 and April 22. If you are a teen or know a teen who wants to make a difference, we are having open calls right now. Participants in these projects will be eligible for a leadership award and volunteer hours for being change makers in their community. For those interested, we're putting more information in the chat below. Now, let me introduce Ian Manuel, a poet, an activist, whose story speaks to many of the challenging and complex conversations that our country is grappling with regarding our justice system. Ian Manuel spent years in isolation after he was condemned to die in prison for a non-homicide offense at 13. In his memoir, My Time Will Come, Manuel tells his story, chronicling his childhood experiences in prison, his reconciliation and friendship with the victim of the crime, and his release in 2016. It was through his writing, through poetry, that Ian was able to set himself free, regardless of his circumstances, to learn about himself and others. Tonight, we'll discuss the power of poetry and the imagination. Welcome, Ian Manuel. Hey, how are you? Good
hey,
to
Jessica.
See you.
Good to see you as well, Jessica. Thank you for having me.
Well, I want everyone to know that I actually know you from New York, where in 2018, you were involved in a project, and we did it in Prospect Park, about isolation before all this all happened.
Yes.
And I had learned about you before and your poetry, and I went out to Brian Stevenson to sort of talk, and then I wrote you. And so these last 3.5 years have been incredible. You've done so much, and I want to talk about the writing. Last time we talked about the memoir and your story. And so I want to start this off. I want to kind of kick off our conversation by going back to a small clip that we put together of that conversation on May 5th with the great Brian Stevenson, and who was incredibly instrumental in helping you get out of prison. And also, as I was saying to you, really kicking off your career as a poet, because he was aware of your poetry, and then he put it in Just Mercy. He put a poem of yours in Just Mercy, or a number of poems. But so I want to just, because you explain a lot and you talk about just the experience, and then I want to sort of launch into your writing and your practice and your people who influence you. But let's begin with the video. So I'm going to just go to the video right now, and okay, then we'll have the conversation.
Okay.
Tell us about that. You're in a cell that's like, what, the size of an elevator? What's in your cell? What's the daily routine?
The daily routine is to fight off the monotony, the break out of the boredom. There's a bunk. If you're lucky and you have a mattress that they haven't stripped you of, you have clothes, you have your Bible. No matter what status you're on, they always let you have your Bible, your Quran, depending on what your religion is. You have a pencil, you have a pen or a piece of paper, a rubber pen, so you don't hurt yourself with it. And so for me, my daily routine was to write. You know, I wrote, I set up like obstacle courses in my cell. How can you set up an obstacle course in your cell? Well, I rewrite Tupac's poems. I rewrite Langston Hughes' poems. I rewrite Maya Angelou's Still I Rise. I challenge myself and tell myself, Ian, if you don't have what it takes, because I had these fantasies of getting out and being this big superstar. You know, I was powerless, so I constantly dreamed of power. You know, when you're stripped of the lowest degree of things, you want the opposite of what you have access to. And so I started rewriting these guys' poetry, and I started sharing them with my fellow prisoners. And the prisoners are tough. They are tougher than Simon Cowell or Sandman on Apollo. You know, they're very, very tough. But these guys would respond to my poetry as if it was the best thing they ever heard. I mean, they would shout, they would clap, they would kick. And this was coming from guys that who had been broken, who had been abandoned, who had been sentenced to life, sentenced to death, guys that just the world had gave up on, whose hearts were hardened. And if I could reach them, they say in New York, you can make it here, you can make it anywhere. But I felt opposite, that if you could make it in prison, you could make it anywhere, because those guys was hard to reach.
I didn't feel like I was really seeing you until I heard those poems, and you would recite some on the phone and you would type them. I'd love for you to just share one with our audience now, just so they can get a sense of what it was that was sustaining you during this time.
Yeah, I'll start with the poem, My Time Will Come, the title of my book. And it says, I promise you, the brunt of my oppression has a purpose. And this same person that you persecute will one day be worshipped. Though I stand before you bare-chested and shirtless, with my soul and emotions naked, just wanting to be nurtured. Yeah, despite the desperation, desertion, and hurting, my time gonna come. Though I composed this poem not knowing if I'll ever be able to perform it in an auditorium, I do it with the faith of a poet that believes he was born to do it. Like an acorn caught up in a storm, flung from the branch where it was born. You can only hold me back for so long. My time gonna come. Despite the difficulties and disappointments, my determination remains undaunted. Though the waters of my tomorrows are deep and uncharted, the buoyance of my character will float unwavering towards them. Like a song written yet unrecorded, my time gonna come. Though you wrapped me in chains and sprayed me with chemical flames and did all of the things you did to add to my pain, my circumstances will change. I believe this with the depths of my being, that as long as this world continues to spin, it cannot end until it's been enjoyed by Ian. Remember this day, because things won't always be this way. My time gonna come. My time gonna come. Against all conceivable odds, my time gonna come. Thank you.
It's so powerful. It's so powerful. We should end the night with the thing that makes your book so extraordinary, and that's your writing, these beautiful, beautiful poems. So if you would, end us tonight with one more poem, please.
I'll end it with the poem that you put in your book, Just Mercy. I still remember you writing me, asking me for permission to include Uncried Tears in your book when I was still in solitary. And I couldn't believe you was asking me for permission when you had took my case for free. But I was so grateful because you said, Ian, now you are published, you will be a published poet. And it'll be easier for me to present you as such when I try to get some of your work in published now. And so I'll end it with Uncried Tears. It says, imagine teardrops left uncried from pain trapped inside, waiting to escape through the windows of your eyes. Why won't you let us out? The tears question the conscience. Relinquish your fears and doubts and heal yourself in the process. The conscience told the tears, I know you really want me to cry, but in releasing you from bondage and gaining your freedom, you die. The tears gave it some thought before giving the conscience an answer. If crying brings you to triumph, then dying's not such a disaster. Uncried tears. And we'll end on that.
You make me want to cry. Anyway, you do.
Don't cry.
So I'm gonna try to, you know, but I'm moved by what you do, and I'm moved by your story. I wanted to talk to you because you mentioned Tupac, you mentioned Langston Hughes, you mentioned Maya Angelou, and you know. I think influence with poets is really interesting, and writers, like, you know, and how you found these people and how you decided these were, and are they still influential to your writing now? Do you, or was it just then? Or are they still, like, just, you know, sort of foundational people that you look at their work again and again now to get inspiration?
Yes and no. So someone I didn't mention also was Eminem. I'm a lyricist. So you have to actually be speaking of something of substance, but you have to deliver it in a way that's so peculiar, that's so different that it stands out to me. I'm difficult to impress when it comes to spoken word, you know? But I wrote then to survive. Writing was my therapy. It was what I had to lean upon to keep from going insane. And so I wrote, and I mean, I've always had this gift of writing. I recall receiving rewards as far as back as the second grade for my reading and writing. But then when reading and writing is all you have that's left, it became like oxygen. It became my lifeline. It became everything that I had to survive, man, my medicine. So yeah, Langston Hughes, Maya Angelou, Tupac Shakur, George Jackson. I could go on and on, man. Eminem, Jay-Z, but you had to be.
I'm curious. In, you know, did you always wrote, but then became your friend. I mean, it became your inner voice. It became the way to ask yourself questions, probably, and it became the person you were talking to. You were talking to yourself. And yeah. Then the literature flew out of that. These poems came out of this kind of discovery of self. I mean, you were discovering parts of yourself you never knew, probably, in order to survive. You know, when did you pick up that pen? And when did you start writing? And I guess my question is also the form of poetry. I mean, it's lyrics too, but the form you took, how did that happen? I mean, I don't want to cut you off. I know that in the original talk with Bryan Stevenson, you mentioned like PBS and them, you know, it was like the bad medicine PBS, and that the slam doc came and you were like riveted. You just felt this was fantastic. and that you looked at that and you went back, like you start, it just started coming. And now, were you writing poetry before then? Was that, or did that just like hearing the slam dunk just open the doors to a whole new way of expressing yourself?
No, I was writing poetry way before I seen the slam dunk. I didn't see the slam dunk until like 2011, 2012. What the slam documentary did was open up a different type of genre of poetry that I wasn't used to. I had only been exposed to academic style poetry, poetry on the page. And even the Tupac book, I wasn't too impressed by the poems, but when I look back, Tupac wrote those poems when he was in high school. And yet he was so far ahead of what was out there at the time that it found its way in a book, you know, but poetry for me became my crutch. It became what I had to utilize to survive. You know, the imagination, Albert Einstein says, imagination is more important than knowledge. And I think that statement, it gets overlooked. But when you peel it apart, here's one of the smartest individuals of the 20th century saying imagination is more important than knowledge. You need to look at that, because imagination gives power to things unseen, you know? And I dive within the depths of my imagination to survive. And it carried me through 18 solid years of solitary. And I rewrote I want to go back to something you said. You said I was talking to myself, and I was figuratively and literally. I used to talk to myself in that cell because I didn't have no one to talk to. But then I needed a way to translate my pain and I found it through poetry, but there was no songs out there that was talking about a 13-year-old growing up in solitary confinement. So and that's very intuitive of you to say that I was talking to myself. I had to create my own poetry and my own story through my lyrics, because no one was talking about this child that had been cast away as a 13-year-old little boy and placed in solitary confinement with a life sentence.
Exactly. I mean, I'm wondering, you know, because you went through adolescence in solitary confinement. So the experiences that adolescents have of falling in love, of understanding their own strengths, of learning, you know, becoming leaders on the basketball team, or, you know, hanging out with groups of kids and, you know, all of that, having crushes, none of that. So, you know, my question to you also is, I mean, you knew, you felt it, your body was growing, you know, all this was coming alive to you, and yet you had to somehow process it through falling in love with an imaginary person almost. I mean, all of this, all these experiences that you knew were part of the world. And did you have someone you shared this work with outside? I mean, I know that you shared it, and I want to talk about when you shared it with all the prisoners, but was there somebody who was like an editor or a person that you sent your work to on the outside and you said like, hey, what do you think?
Yeah.
What was the reaction before you started?
That's a great question. So Brian hired the social worker by the name of Mariah Morrison. She gets talked about a little bit in the book, but not as much as she should. She'll come out more hopefully in with what I have planned next. I don't want to give that away because y'all know that's something you want to ask me. But Mariah was the social worker, and she had a MFA, a degree in creative arts. And
wow.
So, right. And so she came to visit me once a month from starting in 2008. Brian took my case in 2006. Mariah was hired in 2008, and she became my social worker and my lifeline to society. She copied the entire GED book, a chapter at a time, and sent it to me for me to do my to get better at math, because I excel so much at language arts and reading, but my math was so faulty that I would never pass the GED test had it not been for Mariah. But I would send Mariah poems, And I just remember one visit. We were sharing poetry. She was sharing some poetry that she had written. I don't know if she would want me to share, but it was something about her dad's truck and oil or whatever, right? And I just remember sharing my poetry with her during this visit and the look of pure astonishment. And I needed that. That was food to my soul because it was genuine. The look of pure astonishment on her face that this guy sitting across from her in chains and blues, I saw the look of wow, amazement that this guy, that I was valuable. And the Department of Corrections, they try to stump that out you repeatedly. You're nothing. You're just a number. You don't have anything of value to offer the world. And yet here was this woman who had 3 degrees from two to three different colleges sitting across from me, making a human connection. And she was like, Ian, I write poetry, but this, and the look like her eyes growing, like, Ian, I write poetry, but this. And I'm like, I still remember seeing her face, and it let me know that what the guys were feeling in the cells that I was sharing it with also had translated to someone in society, and that I had a gift. I had a special gift to offer the world, and I couldn't wait to get out in society and share it.
Well, I was going to ask you, I mean, how did that make you feel? I mean, because when you're in utter isolation and not with, you know, we're dependent on our community and our loved ones to tell us, you know, we're okay and that we have gifts and everything. I mean, to get that out of, you know, I mean, out of nowhere, really out of nowhere, right? I mean, that kept you going. It kept you going for 18 years. I mean, how did that feel? How did you feel? I mean, not just with what, when her face lit up, what was going on for you? Like, wow, I'm really capable. You know, I mean.
Well, it reminded me of the only person I had ever felt that type of genuine concern and love for him was my grandmother, Linda, which I talk about in my book, My Time Will Come. But to have this, you know, this woman from society come sit across from me, it made me feel really good inside, man. It made me feel like, wow, maybe I do have something of value to offer to society. Not maybe, I felt it. First of all, I always felt different. I've always felt different. I never felt like and I don't know what the terminology of regular human being is, but I always felt different. It's why I've always been a performer and wanted to be a performer ever since I seen Michael Jackson moonwalk in 1984 at Motown 25. That's what I wanted to be. And so anything other than that was me not living in my truth. It was me not living what I was destined to be. So for Mariah Morrison, who Brian hired to sit across from me and her face to light up like that, it was confirmation for me. It was confirmation that I had a gift and something to offer the world.
Let's talk. I mean, I have 2 questions. One, the process of writing every day. Now I want to talk about it now, but I also want to talk about it. I want to talk about when you were in solitary. What did that mean? You got up and did you write for the entire day? You said during the interview, and you talk about it, you set up, like, you know, sort of, you know, courses in your small cell. But did you also say to yourself, like, I'm going to work on this in the morning and work on this later on, and what I'm going to try? I mean, what was your day as a writer like? Because this was your sanity. And also, how did it work? And was it also frustrating? I mean, or was it just the way out? Do you know, I mean, because people have writer's block, they get frustrated. And I'm wondering, you know, in your situation, it was the other self. So there is no writer's block, probably, but maybe I'm wrong. I'm curious. Well,
back then, there was no writer's block. Nowadays, you know, I don't want to answer the question before answering the initial question, but when I was in that cell, there was no writer's block. It was what I had to do in order to survive. And I get motivation from anything. I was so angry at what was being done to me. I channeled that anger. Anger is a strong, it's an energy field, and it has to come out. And I, instead of me hurting someone else or doing something that would extend my time in prison, I would take that surge of energy and channel it through this rubber pen. It would be a conduit, and I would channel it to this piece of paper, man. And I would write. And so sometimes I'd write a poem. I could write a poem in 5 minutes, 10 minutes, but then I would spend the rest of the day perfecting that poem. Like if it didn't sound perfect, I was such a perfectionist. If it didn't sound perfect, if I could not enunciate each word and have this stanza go with the first stanza, then it was not good enough. So I would say it, and then I would rewrite it, and I rewrite it, and I rewrite it, and it was just a special time, man. And sometimes I actually miss being alone with my thoughts, being able to not have the distractions and the responsibility of a job and the distractions of the outside world, because I think when you're living in your gift and living in your moment, you're very close to God. You're very close to God in that sense. And out here with all of these distractions and stuff, you kind of lose that direct line and that direct connection to God. And I had it in that cell. Just think of the Buddhist monks, how they go away from society and go into a hole. And they don't do it because they don't want to be, but they're trying to be closer to God. And I was actually, I've had so many one-on-one conversations with God, and when I, that energy field, energy, God is energy in my opinion. And I was able to connect with God in ways that I'm not able to out here. And I miss it, man. I miss it. Out here, I don't have to survive as much. I don't have to, it's not life or death if I don't write a poem, you know? My life isn't under constant duress out here. So I don't write as much. Every now and then I'll get inspired and I'll see something or I'll hear something and I'll be like, man, I could do that better than that. And I'll pick up a pen. But the constant everyday writing, I don't do it as much, man, and I miss it.
Yeah, I was going to ask you two things. First, you know, when you look at the work that you did, you know, while you were incarcerated, and now you look at what you write now, are they two different men?
Yes, they're definitely two different men. They're definitely two different men. That guy, I was a child, and I did a lot of maturing emotionally. When I was released, I still was pretty much a teenager emotionally. And I've been out here 5 years. You know, I was released in 2016. So I might just be emotionally 19 or 20 years old, right? I mean, I'm a 44-year-old man, but emotionally, I just haven't lived the life that a normal 44-year-old man has. So yeah, they're definitely two different guys. And what was the second?
The second question is really, because you sort of answered it, but I'm interested in like the role of writing now. So you don't have a practice. You don't get up and write the same way anymore. It's
My writing consists of emails. My writing consists of just like everybody else nowadays. I'm writing emails, answering emails, texting and stuff. And I miss it, man. I really wish that desire, that strong desire comes back. Like, I wish I could wake up and say, you know what? I want to rewrite Kanye's album. I don't like the way he did it. You know, the same way I used to wake up and say, I listen to Eminem. And this was back in, everyone talks about Eminem now, like he's this great lyricist. But I remember the time when he wasn't accepted in the Black community, particularly in prison. And it was like, this guy's garbage. So what I did, I took Eminem talking about growing up in a trailer park, flipped the lyrics, and talked about a kid growing up in a solitary confinement cell, getting letters from his mom and dad, and just counting the bricks on the walls. And it was something that the prisoners could relate to, and they lost their minds. But it was literally me taking Eminem style, flipping it, making it my own, and talking about a subject matter that guys that had went through it and experienced it could appreciate more.
How did you decide to share with the, how did you decide to share your work with?
Well, I wanted validation, first of all. I felt I had what it took to be successful in the world, but in order for me to actually make it, the audience would decide. If you think about it, the audience is the one that decides who's successful. Despite how much talent a person has, if the audience isn't going out there spending $13 for that album, then it's a flop, you know? So I had to...
You weren't scared to show.
No, I've never been scared. I've never been scared of the limelight. I've never been scared of the light. I've never been scared of the light. The light is what I've always wanted since I was a kid. It's. I think I was missing something in my childhood that actually I get on the stage. That thing that gaping hole that we all try to fill with some use drugs, some use alcohol. It is the adulation that I get from the audience from watching me do what I was born to do that fills that void for me.
You know, it's interesting because I think, you know, a lot of learning is that you did just on your own, or to give kids poems or to give them short stories and ask, you know, what about the short story or the poem they like, and they rewrite their version. And you just did it on your own without ever anybody saying anything. It just came out of you. Could you read the Maya Angelou poem that you thought through and reconceived with your own imagination for us?
Yes, yes, I can, just as sure as I have it here. And this is one of Maya Angelou's most popular poems, Still I Rise. And I shaped it in a way that was based on my experiences of growing up in solitary confinement. And it says, like the American flag immortalized in Iwo Jima after the bullets and the battle, like a cake in the oven that wasn't supposed to make it out of the batter, like the chest full of breath that expands full of life after its triumph over death from Waterloo to the Heights, like a cloud in the river before it releases rain, like the skin over eyes after awakening from a dream. Though you label me angry and mad, attempting to stick me with your stigmas, your hatred doesn't stagnate the ascension of my potential. Though you set me aflame with your gas, painting me with your can, I laugh like the bird who knows he'll return from the ash. Though you rob me of my youth in a courtroom with the gavel and buried me above ground in a cell without a shovel, I rise like the water in the toilet after flushing, or the diamond from down under that the dirt could no longer cover. Still I rise.
So when you looked at the original poem, I'm just curious that how, you know, you thought to yourself, okay, Maya Angelou did a good job and this is a real popular poem, but I like this premise. I want to do it Ian style. I'm gonna take it, you know, inside myself and bring a rewrite of that poem in terms of my own experience or what I'm feeling.
I wanna own the poem. I wanna take her poem And I want people to remember she did it, but I want people to listen to mine and be like, wow, like this guy embodied it. And I was just talking, I think we all do this as a writer. I mean, not that we rewrite other people's works, but that we want to own the work that we're doing. And so I looked at Maya Angelou's poem. I looked at Eminem's Lose Yourself. I looked at Langston Hughes's poem, I forget, For Life or whatever I did it. And I just wanted to leave my imprint and that people would take away that he wasn't copying Maya's style. He was embodying the poem in his own way.
Yeah, I mean, I think it's really interesting. I mean, now that you're not, what would you, there's a couple of questions. What would you say to a young writer who's struggling with just processing, like, let's just say a teenager, and maybe they're not in solitary confinement, but a teenager who feels really trapped in their own life and who feels, you know, that, and they're writing right now, maybe they're watching right now. What would you say to them about the experience and about sharing and about the process of writing and trusting their imagination?
I would say that the answer is within. We have enough Lil Wayne's. There's only one Drake. There's only one Nicki Minaj. There's only one Jay-Z. They became who they are by going within themselves and talking about their own personal experience. So look within your life. Jay-Z talked about his struggles being a drug dealer. Drake talked about how difficult it was for him to get girls and no one would give him a chance when he was trying to get signed to a label. Look within your own life. There's value there. And find a way. People gravitate towards the truth. And you just have to, people gravitate towards authenticity. No one wants a copycat. Look within yourself, find out whatever you, and channel that energy. You can channel whatever you focus your energy on, you can channel that into becoming what you can manifest who you want to become. Many people tell me, Ian, you're so lucky you got out of prison. You're so lucky you got out of solitary confinement. You're so lucky you got signed to Penguin Random House. You're so lucky Brian Stevenson found you. You're so lucky the lady you shot forgave you. When are you going to stop saying this is luck and start realizing this is manifestation? When are you going to start also realizing that I'm extremely blessed, that I'm anointed, and that we as humans have the power to will things into existence? We do. And I did that. You can't tell me that Sean Coyne, who stays in Los Angeles, told me something the other day when she was at Wanderlust, this huge yoga event. She said, Ian, people was complaining about me being your savior or whatever. And she said, 100 people could have had the sentence you had and not got out of prison. Yet here you are, you will this into existence. And it just started making me think back to all the other times and all the times people told me how lucky I was. I'm not lucky. I'm blessed. So go.
No. I mean, you've made this happen for yourself. There's no doubt in my mind. I mean, when we talk, because, you know, we're starting our whole programming series on resilience, and you're the person, because, I mean, to against all odds, really, you've been able to stay sane in a cell, to be able to write, to be able to go into your imagination, to be able to come up with extraordinary poems, and to be able also to get out. And let's talk about it. You wrote a memoir. I mean, you know, and to sit down and to write a whole memoir and to relive what that is, you know, to have gone through the experience. And then you have to relive something when you then write the story. And so, you know, this is not luck. This is an exceptional person who's got many gifts. Now, I'm going to ask you, what's next? Is it the novel? Is it the movie? What is next for you? Because you're building on this and you're public speaking. you know, there's two prongs. What's next? And how does it feel? It was, you know, it was the MFA social worker woman who was extraordinary and instrumental in life. It was your friends, the prisoners. They were your audience. Now you have these audiences that you perform in front of.
Right.
And how different is that? And what's next for you?
Well, I'll say it's easier now. It's easier. Because like I said, when I was talking to Brian, you take men, for those who might have missed my first speech, you take men that have been broken, abandoned, beaten, left for dead, and you try to reach them, that they're so angry and sometimes that it's difficult. But when you take something that's so powerful and authentic and you're speaking their language, the key is you have to speak that language. And I was talking to them through the pain and through the lens of circumstances that we shared together. So it was tougher then. I love what I do. If you ask me, I don't do it enough. I need a broader audience. You know, I could, they had the VMAs right down the street from my house the other day, and people were clamoring, running to see what stars came in. I stayed in my house because I feel like I belong there. Like, if I'm not on that stage performing, I don't want to see other stars walking into the VMAs. That's not for me. I feel like I have the talent that needs to be, you know, shown in a broader audience. But as far as what's next, I just signed a movie deal. Literally just signed a movie deal. So that could be an film adaptation to my life. Or it could be a regular movie. But my story needs to be told. The criminal justice system needs to be exposed for what they did to a child, you know? The 18 years I spent in an American judicial system in solitary confinement, people wouldn't believe what they did to me. The book only barely scratches the surface of what I seen and what I heard and what I experienced as a child growing up in solitary confinement. So hopefully the movie or the film, the TV adaptation, the series, maybe I'm the new Orange is the New Black, but a film is definitely next in the works. And I can't wait to share my experiences with the world.
When you say that about, it's interesting because when you talk about the movie deal, which congratulations, I think that, you know, is fantastic. But I think to myself, when you say you really love being on stage, I think to myself, what about a one-man show?
So stop. You're like the 100th person to say that, and shout out to my friend and business partner Andy Bernstein, who's helping transform my story into a one-man show. Everybody keeps saying that. So yes, that definitely is a one-man show in the works, and there's some other secret things in the works, but a one-man show about my life and a poetry show is definitely something that we're working on.
All right. You amaze me. That's what I can say. I'm actually going to move to some questions because I think, why not? I think, why not? And I'd like to hear from the audience and just see what they have, what they're curious about. And so here's a question. Are there books that you've read or are currently reading that inform your perspective on life and justice?
Soledad, brother. Soledad. Soledad, brother, by Joyce Jackson. He was from California. He was killed right there in San Quentin prison. That informed my life. From a spiritual standpoint, the book The Seat of the Soul by Gary Zukav is another book that had a huge impact on my life. It's a spiritual book. The Power of Now by Eckhart Tolle is another book that I leaned on in solitary confinement to help get me through. Yeah, those are just a few.
Here's another question. What advice would you give those currently incarcerated and fighting for their freedom?
I would give them the advice that to never give up. That's always light on the end of the tunnel. To fight for your life like your life depended on it. That's what I did. And actually see yourself being free. I used to every day, despite when I was writing poetry, I used to close my eyes and visualize myself walking the streets of society. I used to visualize my mother at the feet, my deceased mother at the feet of God, praying for my freedom. I talk about it in my memoir, My Time Will Come. And also reach out to some of these organizations. Like I reached out to the National Action Network. I reached out to Jesse Jackson's Rainbow Push Coalition, the ACLU. Reach out to them. And even though they didn't help me, the Equal Justice Initiative, which is founded by Brian Stevenson, he found me. So don't never give up, man.
What have been your family and friends' response to your poetry? Is it something that has bonded closer to people in your life? And I'll just add, or not.
My friends, the people that I consider friends, they're blown away by my poetry. I don't really have a lot of family member left. I mean, all of my immediate family passed during my incarceration. I have some uncles and aunts that I left, but they left me for dead during my incarceration and kind of fueled my poetry, so to speak. So I have had no contact with those uncles and aunts, but I've had some contacts with my cousins and they love my poetry.
And do you send them? I'm just curious. Do you send them you have not had a volume of poetry yet. I'm wondering if you're going to put your poetry together and publish it.
Are you going to give the folks everything? That is in the works too. There is a poetry book in the works as well. I totally forgot that. I have so much going on that I didn't mention that. But yes, I have plans to release a poetry book like Tupac did. That poetry world, a lot of people are afraid to release poetry books because they say it doesn't sell well. But I got a feeling that if I put my poetry book out there, that people will be receptive to it. So I'm going to do it.
When you shared it with your family, did you send them particular poems you're proud of, most proud of? Are there particular poems you're most proud of, Ian? I mean, you recite, you've memorized, I don't know how many poems, maybe 15 of your poems, 5 of your poems, something like, I don't know, but you've memorized them.
Between 5 and 10, something like that. So,
and are those the poems?
Go ahead.
Are those the poems that you like the best? Or did you feel that those are the poems when you were in prison that people responded to the most?
So, a little bit of both. There's a political poem I got called Yes, We Did. It was about Barack Obama winning the presidential election back in 08. I literally wrote that poem. And I remember an officer running up to my cell. I was upstairs, running up to my cell door, banging on the door and like, let me get that. Ian, let me get that. I have this blog and people would love that. So to see this officer leave his post and run up to my cell door to get this poem from me, that's a favorite of mine. It's called Yes, We Did. But the poem that really stands out to me is Every Time I Breathe and My Time Will Come. Those are dear to my heart, man. I put a lot of emotion into them.
So listen, I'm going to ask one more question, and then I'm going to ask you to read Yes, We Did.
I don't have it
before
with
we
me.
Close.
I don't
you don't?
I don't have it with me. I don't have it memorized.
Okay, so I want you to come a poem that's memorized after I ask you this question that is one of your favorites, because we heard, you know, When I Breathe. And we heard My Time Is Gonna Come. And then we did hear you read when we played the little film, the piece about tears that's in Just Mercy.
Okay.
And I wanna ask this last question and then think while I'm asking this last question, because I didn't prep you for this at all. This is really a spontaneous conversation, something that really moves you and is an important poem for you.
Okay.
And here's the last question. Can poetry be instrumental by advocacy of revolutionary theory like policy poetry?
Ooh,
Wow, yes, I like that idea. Whoever posed that question, let's get them elected so they can make me the poet laureate of America. That is great. Yes, I agree. It can be, yes. And the poem that I'm going to perform is called Genie in the Bottle. Have you heard it before?
I've never heard that one. I mean, I've heard a bunch of your poems, and, you know, I have my favorites. But I am looking forward to hearing this one.
Okay, Genie in the Bottle. I'm the genie. And to preface this, I wrote this poem and I put it on the internet. I sent it to a friend to post on the internet when I was in solitary confinement. And I got letters from all over the world from people that was like, I'll be your friend. And so this was my first crack at sharing my poetry with the world outside of prison. And it says, I'm the genie in the bottle. The world has forgot. They put me in this abyss and closed up the top. I was a little boy when they did what they did, but time continued to tick and I'm no longer a kid. My mother is dead. And so is my father. I've been abandoned by family while trapped in this bottle. But I hold on to hope that someone will open the top, answer my prayers, and help me out. Sometimes people pick up the bottle and put their eye to the hole. But instead of compassion, act indifferent and cold. I suffer sensory deprivation, a lost sense of direction. There's no mirror in this bottle for me to see my reflection. They say being lonely and alone are two different definitions, but it's only me in this bottle, so I fit both descriptions. What I need, Jessica, is a friend, someone to extend a hand. It could be as simple as picking up a pen. Someone who cares, accepts me for who I am, my magnetic personality, and my baggage from the past. Someone who helps heal the sorrow will work on building our tomorrows. Someone who refuses to leave me to die in this bottle. Thank you.
Wow, Ian. Every time. It's incredible and incredibly moving. And I give you my hand. And I'm sure, as you said, many, many, many people gave their hand to you. And It's great speaking to you. I want to, you know, say that Ian's got this beautiful memoir, you know, My Time Has Come, and please, you know, learn more about Ian and his story. And also, let's leave it with just telling people, or maybe there's a book, something in your life that really inspired you and made you feel just great hope and joy. And maybe we can leave it with the audience that maybe they can have that piece along with your memoir to look forward to, your book of poetry, the movie, the whole package. As I said to you before we got on, I expect you in the next James Bond movie to be Ian, the Ian James Bond character. But really, is there something that you can just think of?
Yeah, the book, The Hurricane, about Hurricane Carter, that gave me a lot of hope and inspiration when I was in prison. This guy fought for his freedom. He wrote about it. The family in Canada got his poem. Denzel Washington played him. The Hurricane. I would recommend that book, man. It gave me a lot of hope and inspiration when I was still in solitary.
Well, you give me hope and inspiration. And
thank you for saying that.
Oh, I feel it's a great gift to have met you several years ago and to watch this beautiful journey. So thank you. And I and thank you all for being here. Thank you for tuning in this evening with Ian Manuel. And thank you. Thank you all, and have a good night. Take care.
Bye-bye.
Aloud is made possible by the Hearst Foundation, the Hollywood Foreign Press Association, the Los Angeles County Department of Arts and Culture, Errant Fox, City National Bank, the Los Angeles Public Library, and additional generous supporters of the Library Foundation of Los Angeles. To support programs like this, become a member at lfla.org.